This is the Context Podcast. Context is a publication of the American Sociological Association, available online at context.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host today, one of your hosts. I'm Ying Chao Gao, a second-year PhD student at Rutgers.
And I am Lilian, a fourth-year sociology student at Rutgers.
Yeah, it's so nice to meet you on air. Today, we will introduce you a very intriguing and insightful article called Can X Can Tell? How Institutional Review Boards Keep Sex in the Closet. You may have known that we usually abbreviate Institutional Review Board as IRB. Now, we have the author of its article online, Professor Janice Irvine, who is professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Massachusetts. She's also the author of book Talk About Sex, The Battles Over Sex Education in the United States.
Ying Chao, just to say that the article is upcoming in the spring issue of Context.
Yep.
So anyone interested, definitely we suggest to read the article in the next issue.
Yeah, of
spring
course.
2012.
Yep. Why don't we start with what IRB really is? What motivated you to do a research about IRB and sexuality issues?
Thank you. Well, thank you both so much for inviting me to have this conversation. I got interested in institutional review boards several years ago when a number of my students had to submit proposals for their research to these boards. And these are bureaucratic mechanisms now in every university across the country that receives any federal funding. So mostly that means all universities have to have IRBs. And a number of my students started having difficulties getting their research projects through the IRBs. So I had this in the back of my mind as a concern, and I started this project about a year ago, not specifically about IRBs, but I was interested in general about sexuality researchers. I've, in a way, spent much of my career studying the people who study sexuality. So I was talking to a colleague of mine about an oral history project I was thinking about doing with some of the older sexologists who are still alive. And we were talking about controversies that had happened back in the 50s and the 60s in the U.S. And he said, oh, well, those don't happen anymore, right? Because now we're such a liberal culture. And I knew that these controversies still happened. And so I said, well, no, they still do. And I told him about one that had happened in Georgia a few years ago. But then I started thinking that we actually don't really have much empirical data about sociologists who are studying sexuality now and what their career experiences are. So I thought I would develop a survey just to find out experiences in general, like how people found the job market to be, were there jobs out there? Once people got jobs, what were their experiences in their departments? Did they really feel that their sexuality research was being valued or not? Were they having difficulties with tenure? And as part of that, I asked questions about institutional review boards.
Right.
And the response was really overwhelming. So that was how I ended up putting together this article.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. I was wondering, Janice, how was your experience with IRB for your personal projects?
Well, that's a really good question. And I personally have never had problems with an IRB, but that's partly because IRBs, as we know them now, have only really cracked down on the social sciences, and so sociology is part of that, around the maybe mid-1990s. So, for example, my dissertation and my first book and even my second book, Talk About Sex,
yes.
I never went through an IRB for those projects. So I did go through an IRB for this survey. which may have been the first time I've ever gone through an IRB, we have a somewhat different setup than many places do, in that we have what's called a local board. So there's a mini IRB in our department that reviews internal projects, so anything that graduate students or other sociology faculty submit. And if it's something that they think is very straightforward, it just gets approved on the departmental IRB level. But if it's something that there's some concern about, it gets sent up to the bigger University of Massachusetts IRB. So something like a survey. I mean, in many ways, my department has really been educated a lot about sexuality research. So right. These kinds of projects don't scare them, and they've passed my projects through. So I've maybe submitted 3 times just mm-hmm. in the last few years, and that's been fine. But for students, and especially I had one student whose project was sent up to the bigger university IRB, his project was rejected. Wow. Maybe 6 years ago. And so that was the reason that I titled this article in context, Can't Ask, Can't Tell, because his project was about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Oh, that's why.
Policy.
Yes. Yes, and I think in part is because, as you mentioned, that there is no empirical research about that. So I guess to change something, it needs really to have a statement about that. So I guess what you are doing is really pushing forward, so that we have empirical data about sexuality research in relation to IRB.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also mentioned a case from Lord Humphreys, who is a pioneer of sexuality in sociology area in the United States. But we're wondering that, if Lord Humphreys was dominated by IRB institution, if he could do this kind of research in 1960s.
Well, there wasn't IRB regulation over sociology then. And so, of course, Humphrey's research became extremely controversial. But he had actually had a lot of oversight by his dissertation committee members who reviewed ethics with him. And the pretty noted sociologist, Earl Babbie, who has written a really prominent book on research. I was speaking with him recently, and he actually thinks that if Lord Humphrey's research was to go in front of an IRB today, that it actually should be approved. Hmm. And that was really interesting to hear, because it's sort of the poster child of ethical violation, and it's in all of the ethics articles about one of the prime examples of research that's bad and problematic and unethical. And so it was really interesting for me to hear Dr. Babbie say that he did not think it was unethical, and that he thought if there were IRB, if it were to go before an IRB today, that he would advocate that it be approved. Because most of us think, there's no way that project would be approved by an IRB now. And I think that's true. An average IRB would scream and go running in the other direction if they got a proposal like that.
Yes, definitely. It just occurred to me, Janice, if there is, you think there is an influence of whether students apply for this research or professors? Because do you think there is any implication about that? Maybe they consider that students don't have that much practice, and they, maybe they will bring more risk.
Well, that's a really good question. And the answer is that we just don't have the data to know. There are just a few studies coming out that actually have looked at the processes by which IRBs make decisions. So you may have heard of Laura Stark's new book, Behind Closed Doors, and which interestingly talks about how one major factor that shapes IRB decisions is how many typos or spelling errors are in a proposal.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, we might imagine that they are influenced by whether somebody is a graduate student or whether they're a professor, but we don't really know that, or I don't know that in relation to sexuality projects. I think my projects also haven't had much difficulty, partly because one was a survey.
Yes.
And partly, as I said, some of the issues that people in my department are really educated around sexuality and don't see it as inherently risky. But also, quite frankly, I write my proposals in a way that I know will reassure the IRB.
You mentioned the IRB board member is coming from your department, but I think it's not the case in other universities.
Yes, that's true.
To deal with this part, the main finding of your research is about there are the personalized discrimination or double standards that are being imposed upon sexuality-related research. Can you talk about this part?
Well, a number of the graduate students who responded to my survey talked about studies that they had submitted, for example, ethnographies. And friends of theirs who were also graduate students submitted IRB proposals at the same time for similar kinds of ethnographic projects, but that didn't have to do with sexuality. And the sexuality researchers often reported that their projects got held up and took months and months longer than very similar projects that weren't about sexuality. So that's one possibility, I think, that could be explored more empirically to see if that seems to be a tendency. I also found some real ironies in this whole idea of ethical regulation by IRBs. So in one of my recent projects, it's based on individual interviews and focus groups. And so I'm doing a project on the Walk of Shame. So I'm using undergraduates at my university and at other universities nearby. So in some cases, I'll go into classrooms and almost use a classroom as a focus group. So this project, I submitted it to the IRB and it was approved. And so I have informed consent forms that students have to sign. But I realized when I went into my first classroom that there's actually no way that I would have any person's name except for the fact that they have to sign this consent form. Because I don't ask their names.
Right.
They don't tell me their names. And so the only place in the world that their actual name exists is on this consent form.
Right, absolutely.
So it's a real paradox.
Yeah.
So I went to the IRB chairperson and I explained this and I said, this is a real problem. Why do I have to do this consent form? It just seems like it's, it's making the problem worse. But they really can't have you not do a consent form. So I was stuck with the consent form and I decided that what I would do is just have them put their first names on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a weird set of ironies that often are put into play.
Yes, it sounds also like a vicious circle. And for me, there's the question, what is the institution above IRB or how IRB makes these decisions? Because as you said, you address the question, but they say we have to. And I think that's very interesting, that they have to, and who is changing that have to, or when can be changed?
Well, there's a really useful book about IRBs that reviews a lot of this history by Zachary Schrag, who's a historian, and the book is Ethical Imperialism. And he talks a lot about how IRBs have evolved really away from actually protecting human subjects and more toward protecting the university.
Right.
And, protecting universities from lawsuits, basically. which is what they're afraid of. So I think that's part of how a lot of these policies are applied in ways that really don't make sense, but they keep being applied in those ways.
Right. I was wondering, Janice, because definitely there are so many arguments in your article that there are fewer risks in the research on sexuality than IRB suggests. But do you think there are still any risks involved in the sexuality research?
Well, I think what I really wanted to say in that article is that I don't think that sexuality is a unique area of research that's different from all other areas of sociological inquiry. So I don't think that there are, that it's problematic or risky in particular ways that many IRBs seem to regard it. And in terms of sociological research methods like surveys or interviews or ethnographic procedures, it's hard for me to see where the risks would be in that. Mm. You know, as long as research is developed according to, you know, basic ethical sociological principles,
right.
I don't think just talking to people about sexuality is dangerous. IRBs in general were developed in relation to biomedical research or behavioral research of the kinds that psychologists tend to do. But when it's applied to surveys or interviews, I just don't see those as inherently risky or harmful, or certainly not in ways that people don't have control over. You don't have to take a survey, or you can just stop taking it. You can stop an interview at any time.
Yes.
That's really quite different than, you know, having a medical procedure done on you.
Exactly. We should address the methodological and epistemological differences between sexuality research in social science and the research in biological or medical studies in terms of potential damages or risks to interviewees. I would like to share a different observation in my project of Taiwanese uniform fetishism and BDSM, which are acronyms for bondage discipline, dominant submission, and sadomasochism subculture. While IRBs may imply that my interview and ethnography with BDSM practitioners are risky to them, some of my interviewees and other BDSM researchers in Taiwan argue that they feel it is a process of healing and counseling instead. During the research, they have chances to recall, retrospect, and reflect more deeply on their stories of sexuality. It may be more helpful to speak their personal experiences to an affirmative sexuality researcher than a random counselor. At this point, my interviewees may hold different perspectives toward the extent that risks or benefits that sexuality-related research may generate.
Right, exactly. I think that's, you know, a really interesting story that just illustrates this point.
Right. Your article provides a lot of ironic stories about respondents' experiences with IRB, just like one of that I just mentioned. Can you share more stories with our audience?
Well, the one thing that struck me over and over again was how IRBs tended to see, as you were saying, see people who were being asked anything about their sexuality, especially if they have some kind of non-normative minority sexuality. IRBs have a tendency to see that as risk, putting the subjects at risk. And this happened over and over again. And so they would require, for example, that people's names not be used, even when subjects wanted their names to be used in the research.
Right.
One person talked about doing research at a pride organization.
Yes. Which is a quite public event.
She wasn't allowed to use the names, and the people were in a pride organization. So this is a fundamental way that the members of that IRB just really do not understand this research, and they don't understand the communities that are being studied. And that's a problem, because IRBs are supposed to have someone on the board with expertise in the area of the proposals that they're considering.
Yes.
And I think it's very rare that IRBs have sexuality researchers on their boards.
Yes, that's very interesting, because that's what I was wondering. Who are the members of IRB usually, and if they change or modify according to the projects they are taking decisions about. You just answered it, that maybe sometimes there is not even a sexuality researcher in the board.
Right, I think that's right. Yeah, because it's a new field in general, so there aren't even people on campus who do that kind of research.
Mm.
In your words quoted from the article, quote, IRBs that presume sexuality is risky prohibit the production of sexual knowledge and silence the voices of diverse sexualities, knowledge which might itself challenge cultural fears about sex, unquote. If we could step forward, can we infer that the lack of knowledge decreases opportunities of minority to speak for themselves, weakens their power to struggle with sexual hierarchies, which may lead to reinforce the existing stereotypes and sexual bias? In short, can we say that IRB's examination based upon unexamined sexual ideologies may perpetuate existing sexual hierarchies like heteronormativity and limit the chances to challenge them?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And so as state bureaucracies, IRBs are operating often in these ways that aren't visible. And so that's partly what I was hoping to do in this article, is make visible some of the ways in which IRBs really are working to sort of reinforce heteronormative hierarchies.
Yes, and I think that proves the fact that, doing research is not just a technical thing. It's very interactive and has implications for personal change, as you, Inchao, said, and also political implications.
Right.
Well, I wish I did have an easy way to change this. The Office for Human Research Protections is in the process of trying to change, and what they're saying is improve their rules for protecting human research subjects. So they've put forward a number of changes that they're saying will enhance the effectiveness of oversight, but also exempt, maybe create more latitude for social science research. But there's still some troubling pieces of that. There's one section where it suggests that surveys, for example, might be considered under the exempt category unless it deals with, quote, emotionally charged topics, unquote. But one could imagine that many IRB members would see anything about sexuality as being emotionally charged.
Yes.
So once again, we're back in the same old dilemma. So even if these new regulations come along, I'm still a little bit worried about how sexuality research will fare under them.
You know, there are a lot of graduate or undergraduate students are our audience of podcasts. And they are wondering that if they can go further in the track of sexuality-related research. And you mentioned that there are some students are discouraged by their advisors that they will face a lot of risky or challenge in the procedure of IRB member. After you did this research, would you have some suggestions for those students of sexuality in terms of protracted surveillance or the challenge faced by sexuality?
Well, I would encourage students to stay in this field. Sexuality research is incredibly vibrant and exciting. It's a young field in sociology. It's growing rapidly. So there are lots of us. I do think that this dynamic will have to change over the decades, and it will only change if there are more and more and more of us. So in the meantime, I would just encourage students to work closely with their mentors and faculty chairs of their committees to figure out ways to write their proposals and, you know, try to navigate the IRB process. But I would advise people to not give up.
Right, absolutely.
Yes, that's. I think that's a very good closing statement. Thank you so much, Janice.
Yeah.
Yes, then we are going to encourage our audience to read the article in the next issue of Context, Spring 2012. And they will know about more about these issues. And I think many people don't even know about the IRB, right? The Institutional Review Board. And as I was saying to Ying Chao at the before we started the interview, I'm an international student. And when I came to the United States, I had a colleague that was studying also the decisions made by IRB. And he was using so often the abbreviation IRB that I didn't know what it means. So to me, it was like, maybe that's a music style, like R&B, or what's that? So yeah. Now I know that's not a music style.
I think IRB is not as cool as R&B.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Janice, for this interview. And I really hope you will make an impact for further research in this area.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Janice.
That's all for this episode of the Context Podcast. Keep your eye on context.org for more episodes soon.